Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world via the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, welcome, Amy. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good this morning. Beautiful day in Brisbane.
It is, and we're sitting in Parliament House, the annex of Parliament House.
First time I've been here, so it's exciting.
There you go. We're doing an outside broadcast. Let's Talk is coming to you from the annex of Parliament House in Brisbane. It's the ICE Roundtable, and there are a number of people have been brought together to sit down and discuss this this issue of ICE in our community. So we've got a number of people, from Western Australia and North Queensland and Northwestern Queensland, people from everywhere. But to start off with, we've got Associate Professor Ted Wilkes from the National Drug Research Institute, and also Professor Dennis Gray of the same organisation joining us. Ted, welcome to the program. How are you, brother?
Good, Ty. Good to see you and catch up with you personally.
It's been a while.
It has been a while, yeah, and it's a long way from Western Australia over, I can tell you. And I've got to go back tomorrow, and it's a long way back, but it'll be a great thing to go back home.
Always good to get home. Tell us your mob, your country.
Yeah, I'm a Whadjuk Noongar man. I belong to one of the 13 clans of the Noongar people in the southwest of Australia. And the clan around Perth is the Whadjuk Noongar clan. And down through my father's people, I have a connection back to that country before white fellows ever got there. But I got grandmothers and others that have come through from the desert and from the north of our country. And I got a little bit of an international flavour about me, but I won't go into that.
You're a senior advisor with the government on alcohol and other drugs and have been for some 10 years. I want to come back to that and just say, what have you seen in that 10 years? Is the government sort of taken heed the advice or the information that goes back and forth and what have you? But before I do, I've got to welcome Professor Dennis Gray. How are you, Dennis?
I'm very well, thanks, Taya. It's a real pleasure to be here and talking to you guys.
And your mob country, where are you from?
I was born in England but came out to Australia when I was 4 years old, so it's a very long time.
I was
going to
say, you don't
time.
Have an accent.
Because I'm in my late 60s, yeah. And grew up in Perth, but travelled around quite a bit, both within Australia, worked with Aboriginal people in the north of WA, but spent a lot of time overseas as well.
And you're involved in the issue of drugs, alcohol and drugs and things in the Aboriginal community?
Yes, with Ted, I manage the Aboriginal Research Program at the National Drug Research Institute, and I was one of two non-Aboriginal members on the old National Indigenous Drug and Alcohol Committee, which Ted chaired.
All right. I just want to ask Ted, in that 10 years of being an advisor, a senior advisor with government, what do you see looking back over that 10 years? Has the government...
Successive governments, because it hasn't
yes, exactly.
been one.
Successive governments. There's been a number of governments. Do they hear? Do they listen? Do they hear? Do they take on board? How do you feel?
Well, obviously I feel frustrated, Tig. The 10-year span, and it's a little bit more than 10 years, there have been some positive results that have come out. At least the information that that governments have required about the needs of Aboriginal people have been put to them. So we've been putting the needs there. It's frustrating because they haven't been providing the right resource and the right mix of service delivery back to our people. So I've identified that we need a lot more treatment and rehabilitation services out in our world for Aboriginal Australians to access. There are other issues that are dynamic in the sense that we've known, Dennis and I have known, and we talk about it all the time, that there's never been a proper resource base provided by governments around this country, and we ask them why. They know the disadvantage of Aboriginal Australia is at least twofold, and I say it's threefold in alcohol and drugs, and in some cases we're right off the grid, you know. And we don't know what the answer is around some of the drugs, but look, today we're talking about ICE. And in the past, in my world of being a leader in this field, I've seen drugs emerge. I've seen cannabis emerge from out of the cities, and all of a sudden it's in every little nook and cranny around in remote Australia, in rural Australia. I've seen our mob try to escape from some of the ills of society, what we might call the disadvantage and the oppression that comes through with the racism towards our people. And we use drugs. Some of us use it to medicate, to get away from that. And so we blot out our minds. But I've also seen people use drugs, and including the two legal drugs, tobacco and alcohol, to recreate. You know, people probably think it's good fun. Well, it, you know, I sit around the dining table and have a couple of glasses of wine, and, you know, I quite enjoy that, discussing issues with people while I'm doing that. So there are reasons why we do these things. Governments need to be a lot more supportive of the Aboriginal leadership to lead the charge, to drive the engines of change. We've had enough of the paternalism that comes out of governments and some of the systems, and we're saying to governments today, we Aboriginal people know what's required, and with colleagues like Professor Dennis Gray, we can do this. We can fix up Aboriginal Australia's ills around alcohol and drugs.
Well, it goes without saying, Ted, we live with the problem, or problems. We must know the solutions. We just need the resources. We need the assistance of people like Dennis Gray working with us. But governments are the first that have got to come to the table.
And you articulated really well just how much of a problem alcohol and drugs still are. And ICE seems to be another problem. It just seems to be, you know, just that other thing we have to worry about. There's a lot of misconception amongst our mob as well about how prevalent it is, whether it's an epidemic or whether it's not. First of all, how do you define an epidemic? Is there a easy way to define it? And what is our situation you're seeing around the country in relation to ICE compared to alcohol and other drugs?
It's an interesting question. And the word epidemic to me means a lot more pain and a lot more misuse and abuse of the drug. At this stage, in Aboriginal Australia in particular, we don't have the ability to quantify how much use is going on. But we can tell you that the drug ICE is a lot purer than the purest form of amphetamine. So it's called methamphetamine, and it's a strong drug. And our people are saying that it creates mindsets within some of our young fellows and older fellows that causes them to become aggressive, to become violent, and that's where the concern is. And we're not sure whether there's been a marked increase in the use amongst our people. We think there has been.
Yep.
And I can probably tell you that in the families and in the regions where I live, it appears that that's the case. And when you know there's smoke, we say there's fire. And so people like me and Dennis will want to quantify this stuff. We'll want to, yeah.
Can I come in there? In answer to your first question, an epidemic is a major outbreak of an illness or a health problem.
Yeah.
It affects a large proportion of the population. And I think that we're certainly not at that stage with ICE. If I can just talk about what's happening in the non-Aboriginal population for a moment, what the evidence seems to show there is that there hasn't been an increase in the number of people, non-Aboriginal people, using ICE. What has happened is that this purer form of amphetamine, methamphetamine, has become available, and it's causing more harm amongst those that are using. Now, we've got some evidence which says that the rate of amphetamine use amongst Aboriginal people is 50% higher than amongst non-Aboriginal people. That's probably an underestimate, as Ted said. You know, we know that it's emerged in some communities, not in others, and I think we're not at the stage where it's an epidemic, but I think what's important is to take action now before the problem does get larger.
Could you see, I mean, you mentioned cannabis before, and now it's almost commonplace in a lot of Aboriginal communities. Do you see a situation where it could end up being almost accepted or commonplace in the same way that cannabis sort of spread out from the cities and into sort of the bush?
Well, for sure. You know, drug use amongst the mainstream population and our mob is common. It's accepted that the police have actually said quite clearly that they're not going to be able to arrest their way out of this. Rightio, and you can put as much resource into policing and law enforcement, but you aren't going to stop drug and illegal drugs being available in Australia. You know, they're available in prisons, and if people in prisons can get access to drugs and they're locked up in cells and they've got barbed wire fences around the outside, well, we aren't going to protect it out in the normal community. So, yeah.
And it just seems really scary because if you're taking the example of alcohol and just how politically charged it is, I'm just thinking of the Northern Territory, they just seem to be taking so many steps backwards. I mean, can we even deal with this problem considering our political environment, the focus on law and order and the fact we can't even get such a huge problem like alcohol right? And it's something that's been affecting our communities for 200 years.
Yeah, look, we do have a system around Australia called the AMPs, the Alcohol Management Plans. And, look, you know, some of these are not working for simple things because of simple reasons, like communities are not happy with the principles and the protocols that have been put in place. And at that local level, if we can drill down to the local level and we can say to people at the local level, it's really your choice. What do you want? Do you want to restrict alcohol? Do you want to have certain rules in place? And if the people in the majority say very clearly that that's what they want, well, then they're probably going to work. I always maintain if you own something, you're going to make it work.
Yep.
But, look, alcohol in the Northern Territory is certainly a big issue. The Northern Territories are the biggest consumers of alcohol. And if you take out the blackfellas up in Northern Territory, the Aboriginal mob, it's still, the white fellas are still the biggest consumers of alcohol.
We did research in the Northern Territory which shows that if every Aboriginal person in the Territory stopped drinking today, consumption levels amongst non-Aboriginal people in the Territory would still be around 40% higher than the national average.
Wow.
So there's a lot of...
White fellas have a problem with alcohol, not so much.
Oh, that's right. I think there's a big problem of alcohol amongst non-Aboriginal people, in not just in the Territory, but around the country. And I think that one of Ted talked about alcohol management. In some communities, they have made a decision that they want to restrict it. But I think where it doesn't work is when governments try to impose those restrictions on people. And I think one of the issues is that it's an easy thing for government to do, to say, oh, we're going to bring in an alcohol management plan in community X or community Y. They do that, but they don't get to the real underlying reasons why people are drinking or why they are taking drugs. Mm-hmm. And we're not doing enough in the areas of prevention and treatment for those who are afflicted.
And I think it was interesting you're talking about the AMPs because it was something the Queensland Police Commissioner were talking about in relation to certain communities who have AMPs, mainly Yarrabah, about the AMPs restricting alcohol and that sort of paving the way for ICE use. But you were talking before about the fact that it's actually very rare to switch between different drugs, between different evils, isn't it?
Well, it's how we define it, but rare is probably not the best word. People do find occasion to switch, you know, but it's not their preferred way of doing things. So it sometimes swings on the availability of particular drugs. If you're a cannabis user, you're probably going to stick with cannabis if it's available. If you've got into using ice, yeah, you're probably going to want to use ice. But if ice isn't available, you know, you're probably prone, because you want to get that escape again, to either reverting back to drinking cheap forms of alcohol or other substances, you know.
I think one of the big determinants of the drugs that people use is price, and that one of the issues with ice is that it's an expensive drug, and that people can't consume as much of it as they would alcohol. And I think one of the most effective measures with controlling alcohol, for example, in the Northern Territory, in Alice Springs, they've banned cask wine, and they've banned 2-litre casks of fortified wine. And what happens is they've taken the cheapest grog off the market. There's been some switch to full-strength alcohol, but they can't buy nearly as much full-strength beer as they could the cask wine. So consumption's actually gone down in Alice Springs.
Yeah. Do we have the resources, the information and resources, or what is required to try to manage the situation of ice spreading into every little nook and cranny?
We require a lot more data and information about how substantial it really is in our communities. We require to talk to those people who work in the health services, so the AMSs and the AOD services, the Aboriginal mob and our non-Aboriginal partners as well and colleagues. And we need to understand that there ain't no real treatment regimes in place at the moment for ICE. Okay, but we do know that cognitive behavioural therapy is something which people should access. So if we can get to the right people, the psychologists and the counsellors and some of our Aboriginal counsellors, to be able to sit down with people and say, hey, you're going to be in this for a hard road, but we can do it. And, you know, we have interventions like Back to Country. So this is purely Aboriginal. Saying to Aboriginal people who were caught up in drugs, hey, where do you come from, young fella? Or where do you come from, brother? And if they say, well, I'm down in the city living now, but I'm actually from up Yarrabah or I'm from up Cairns Way. And, you know, and we now know that if you get people back to country, back to loved ones, they can actually start to heal themselves. And it's not going to happen overnight. These healings will take at least 6 to 2 years, 6 months to 2 years, okay?
Can I come in there? Because I think the biggest way to prevent this problem is prevention. And the, you know, drug use, alcohol use is across all segments of society. But work done for the World Health Organization clearly shows that disadvantaged people are much more likely to consume alcohol, tobacco and illicit drugs in far larger quantities. And the way to prevent that is to improve the living conditions and lifestyles of those people. And clearly, you know, we've had various governments since the 70s who've got so-called Aboriginal advancement programs, but they've never, ever done enough to overcome the disadvantage faced by a large proportion of the Aboriginal community. And that's what we've got to do.
Yeah. Right. I'm interested, we're at a stage in sort of national debate where we're talking a lot about domestic violence, not so much family violence in Aboriginal communities, but a lot of violence is fueled by alcohol. I'm wondering if there's a difference between alcohol-fueled violence and ICE-fueled violence.
Well, as I said before, it's hard to determine, but we're getting anecdotal evidence that people who are on the ICE are quite aggressive, and violence seems to be enhanced by some of these people. Now, whether people understand that there might also be a comorbidity. Some people who have a mental health or are already stressed out, and then you take a drug on top of an alcohol is one of the examples. You do alcohol while you've got a mental health issue, you can see that violence occurs and people are wanting this outlet, and sometimes they take it out on their loved ones. But it's certainly the case with ICE as well that, you know, once you start mixing drugs, and our people are poly-drug users. They'll smoke a cigarette, they'll get home and they'll drink a couple of cans, and then they'll go down the road and they'll get a bit of marijuana. And those of them that are doing ICE will go around the corner and get a bit of ICE or a bit of speed and put it in the pipe. So we know all this occurs, and sometimes it's hard to just blame one drug, you know. Yeah.
Again, I'd like to come in there. I think one of the things is that some people actually use ICE so they can stay awake and drink all night, and that's a common thing in some of the night spots around. And so you've got this mixture of alcohol and amphetamines, yeah. And it's a deadly mixture, not a deadly mixture, but it's a potent mixture which often results in violence.
And it's actually interesting because we were talking to Elsa Lively from up Yarrabah, and she runs one of the rehabilitation centres up there, and she was talking about ICE is getting into Yarrabah through, they're actually lacing marijuana with ICE, apparently. So that's another problem that's been happening, yeah. And getting people hooked on ICE.
Yeah, that's it's a common thing that people will lace pot or tobacco, and it's noticeable. That people probably have preferred ways of consuming drugs. So some people will inject it.
Yep.
Some people feel a lot comfortable smoking it and they don't see anything wrong with smoking it, but smoking it's just as bad as injecting. So, look, at the end of the day, when you work in alcohol and drugs, you got to know that there's a broad sweep of drugs available. And, you know, our young fellows who can't afford the cheap alcohol or the marijuana or the ice. They're going around the corner and they're buying sniffable products out of hardware stores, and they go around the corner and they sniff it. I saw something wonderful happen when I was the chairperson of NIDAC, and that was that the government worked in with us, and we were able to roll out a non-sniffable fill in the middle of Australia, because a lot of our young fellas in the desert and in remote Australia were sniffing petrol.
That's actually one of the good things that the Abbott government did in health. One of the one good things was the Opal Fuel rollout.
Yeah, and we were in partnership with them, and that's Aboriginal leaders and some of our non-Aboriginal colleagues were in partnership with the Howard government to say to the petrol companies, you need to stop selling sniffable fills in remote Australia. And it happened.
We need to wind up. We've got a lineup of guests waiting to come in.
Thank you so much, though. That was really, and hopefully catch up with you soon as well. Yeah. Get you
thanks,
back on
Ted.
The program.
Yep, and thank you, Dennis.
Thanks, Tig.
Thanks very much for having us on the program.
It's great to have you guys. Thank you very much. Let's Talk is coming to you live out of the annex of Parliament House here in Brisbane. We are there is an ICE roundtable, a gathering of people. Here today to talk about the issue of ICE and other drugs as well. As you heard Ted say, it's we have there's a big problem with alcohol still.
ICE is sort of the added problem
on top
of the horrible problems we have with alcohol in our community. So
exactly, yeah.
It's a really complicated issue.
Certainly is. Now joining us today, Gail Wason. From Mulungu Aboriginal Corporation in Mareeba. And we have Dr. John.
Mark Wenatong.
Mark Wenatong.
He's famous. How don't you know Mark Wenatong?
Yes, Dr. Mark. Sorry, Mark. Gail, tell us your mob country.
Jungan, Wakaman, are my people. And that's west of Cairns, Chiligo, Mareeba, Dimbula area.
All right. And your capacity at Mulungu?
I'm the CEO of the Aboriginal Corporation. It's a primary healthcare service, delivering services to the Mareeba area and surrounding districts. So
is that like your community-controlled health agency, is it?
Yes, it is. It's... It is a large community-controlled health service on the Tablelands, whereas in Cairns you've got Wootropperin and Yarraba and you've got Gundaja. Yes, we're one of them up in the Tablelands.
And John Wenatong, welcome to the program. John Wenatong, sorry, man, now I've got into the calling your brother, talking to your brother and not you. Well, there you go. Mark, tell us your mob, your country.
Cubby, so just north of here. We are in Brisbane today. Yeah. Just north of here. And I'm the public health medical officer at Punapima. So we deliver Aboriginal community controlled primary health care to Cape York.
How long have you been doctor for?
Oh, gee. since 1994. How long is that? Yeah,
that's.
94. 20 years. 20 years, yeah.
It's interesting. So you're sort of represent. You've got knowledge of a whole heap of different communities in the Cape. You've got knowledge of Mareeba. I'm interested in seeing how it's affecting ICE, particularly affecting different communities. Because you were saying before, Gail, that it's not so much a problem in Mareeba, but you always hear about Cape York and that it's potentially going into a lot of communities up there. So I'm interested in the different ways that's affecting different communities.
Well, I hear that it's tinkering in our area, but we don't have any evidence of it. Police may have or someone else may have, but our service doesn't. It hasn't come to the forefront, but drugs and through cannabis and alcohol are the main usage in our areas.
Mark, what's your view on it?
We started a strategy about 8 or 9 months ago for ICE in Cape York. So we've had our ears pretty close to the ground up there. We don't have the same problems they have in rural Victoria and places like that yet. So the point of our strategy was to get in early to provide a really negative community kind of perception of ICE. and to stop it from getting in, you know, in the first place. So currently we set up monitoring through all the primary healthcare services and the two hospitals up there. So if anybody comes in with an eye psychosis and stuff like that, we'll know about it. But there's only been one in the last 6 months. There's been a few Cape York people, though, that have gone into Cairns Base for eye psychosis while they've been in Cairns. And the rest of the stuff that we hear is just from people on the ground kind of saying, yeah, they know it's around. So far, though, like, it's that tip of the iceberg stuff. The health services hear about this towards the end, generally, because we just see the results of it. So we started working with a drug squad up there to try and get an idea of if they knew if there was drug, the places it was getting in and stuff like that. And they probably knew less than us, really, in that sense. But we've had offers now from the district coroner as well. So for any suspicious deaths up that way, there's toxicology on all their blood, so we'll know if anybody's been using ice. And so far, none. And we do regular health checks on a lot of the, especially young men up there, so from 15 to about 50. And in all the last men's health checks that I've done up there, like Arakoon, Cohen, and a few other places, the guys have kind of said, no, not really. There's like a lot of marijuana around, you know, because there has been for a fair while up that way, but not so much ice. And this is a really good thing. People are still really worried about it, and people always have relatives that have been affected somewhere along the line. But so far we've got some strategies in place. We started a partnership with the Cowboys up there as well, so we've got JT's poster out there, you know, in the community saying take no ice and stuff like that. Did some focus groups with some of the young people up there and designed some education messages based on what they thought was a good idea. Then we put it on our Facebook and got a whole bunch of young people from Cape to like it, and ended up with 28,000 hits in about 2 weeks. So most of them won't be from the Cape, but at least we know we've still got it to our target group up there through social media. So so that kind of thing's happening, but all these things aren't the answer. The answer is communities taking control and providing that really negative perception, making people not want to take it, discouraging dealers coming in and all that kind of stuff. So so I think it's early days up there. We wouldn't be surprised if there's ice labs and stuff like that up there, because
it's easy to conceal, isn't it? Because you can go out in the bush, whereas here it's really hard. You can smell it.
Yeah. We're also worried about the cost, you know. Like if it does get as cheap as what Senator Jackie was saying last night, you know, $12 a point or something like that, which I think is a hit, or point one of a gram or something, like a tenth of a gram, then that's a real worry. I mean, at the moment, you know, like what will happen up there is if people want to share sly grog, you know, you can buy a bottle of scotch and 10 people can drink that and all throw in $20 or whatever it is, you know. You can't share this kind of stuff that same way, as far as we know anyway, if, you know, unless you've got money, the cash. So hopefully the whole business model isn't very good for up there, but it's early days yet. We want to get in ahead of it. We think we may be, you know, kind of a little bit ahead of the game up there, so that's a really good thing, and them communities are really starting to gear up themselves.
Gail, do you feel the same way? I think it was interesting, this idea of community control, because often we don't feel we have a lot of control over the issues that are affecting our communities, considering that it hasn't gotten in so much into your community. Do you feel that you have the ability to control it if it does start trickling in and if it does start to become a problem?
If it does, it's the same thing. We need to get in with our community and have some strategies around what we're going to do. And, you know, with community control, it is about listening to our community. It is about engaging with our mob, and our mob, you know, numbers of Indigenous people are employed by us. So it is about us and our ability to be able to come up with the strategies and roll it out within our workforce.
How important is these sort of gatherings, this particular round table, how important is that to you and in your community?
At the moment, it's about learning, because we don't have the issues in our communities. It's about learning what else is there. Over the last 2 days, we've heard from a lot of prominent speakers and people who are dealing with it, and what are the signs and, you know, the costs and how it is affecting our mob. So we've been learning about that over the last 2 days, or hearing about it. And today is about another talking and gathering social networks, so that we can also learn what is happening and how we're going to deal with it, but try to influence people about you know, our mob know, Aboriginal people know what's best for us and how to deal with it. We have the holistic models. We don't work in isolation. So that's one of the things that we can share is how we roll out or implement programs in our community is designed because of us designing it. But how do we work with others and how do others work with us? You know, we know that today that a lot of people, a lot of organisations are getting funding to address different issues within all our communities. But how are they working with the Aboriginal people to roll it out? Yeah. How are they listening to us to engage us and work with us to actually do the hard work on the ground?
Mark, in dealing with ICE, can you deal with it like dealing with a cluster of things? There's alcohols are still a big issue. Smoking cigarettes, tobacco, you know, still a big issue in our communities. And now ICE is starting to gain some attention and widespread use. Can we deal with ICE in while we're dealing with alcohol and smoking? What's the difference here? What strategies are required?
Yeah. Look, I think the only difference is that one's illicit and the others are not illicit, and this is a problem because you know we had the Cape York Summit a couple of months ago with it, which was mostly organisations from up there, and we had a session on ICE and things. And it is hard for older people in communities to say to younger people, don't take ICE when they're sitting there with a cigarette hanging out of their mouth or drinking a beer of sly grog and kind of knowing that cigarettes will kill more people than ICE ever will. So there's kind of some things there that make it a bit hard. But what we put to that parliamentary committee on harmful use of alcohol in remote communities was exactly that, is that you can't take any of these things in isolation. Like, it's about people's social and emotional well-being and whether they will be mental health issues or whether the places they live in are just pretty crap, and you know you need some kind of outlet and stuff like that. So there's a whole lot of things that I think we need to think about here, and I'm you know, one of the ones in our organisation is one of the ones that really pushes for a very broad response to this, so it's not just targeting one thing at a time. And even with the grog stuff, you know, it's the same kind of thing. You know, why do you get addiction, and even whether it is addiction in our communities, because people can go without drinks for 2 weeks and then hit it up, you know. So there's kind of some really different things happening in some of these communities, and we know we can't address just the drug stuff. It's got to be social and emotional wellbeing. It's got to be couched in the stuff that we're just talking about here. That from a community control perspective, holistic, comprehensive, and making sure we're trying to actually address the causes as well as intervene where we can in the you know, current kind of acute issues. So biggie, yeah.
So a state of health, housing, education, employment, all of these things are fundamental.
Yeah.
And not deal in isolation with cigarette smoking or ice or whatever it might be, because that's where the pressure, like when pressures and frustration arise. Yeah.
I'm interested in this. It's a very proactive view that you're both taking. In relation to other illicit substances, for example, or other really dangerous practices, for example, marijuana and petrol sniffing, has there been cases of Aboriginal-controlled community organisations actually taking a proactive view, a proactive response rather than a reactive response, like you're doing with ICE? Has this happened before?
Yes, for us, it's about empowering families, empowering our men and strengthening the elders to take their rightful place, to encourage family to get together, to strengthen each other so that we then can help families deal with it, because the person in their family may have the issue. But how do we, and it impacts on grandma, it impacts on the children in the family, it impacts on mum and dad. How do we help them to be good parents, to help their child? That's the important thing. That's what we need to roll the programs
building out. Our communities up, yeah.
Good of you, Mark.
Yeah, look, I absolutely agree with that. This is about everything seems to come back in around dysfunction or ill health, etc., to early childhood and family environment and the community environment. If we can get that right, we can go a long way to solving a whole lot of things at the same time, because, you know, out of that environment comes all of the substance misuse stuff, and as well as chronic disease, as well as obesity and all the other things that are besetting. But the hard part especially for the remote communities, is there's so little there to start with. So if these kind of things come in, their effect could potentially be, even though it's just a single kind of illicit drug, their potential effect could be bigger than some of the others that we've had in the past. So, you know, we try and manage in a remote community at 9 o'clock at night somebody who's psychotic, and there may be only one nurse available, and you need to sedate these kind of people, you know, and get them somewhere safe, and that's not easy to do. So we might not have the infrastructure to make a really big response if this kind of stuff comes in. The other thing is, because we've got communities with so little disposable income, if they're spending on drugs, then we have to think about the consequences of that. So if you can't pay for drugs, what do? You either become a dealer, turn to crime and rob your own mob, or prostitution. You know, and that's what we don't want to see.
I was reading actually in The Australian, it was comments from you, Mark, about how urgent this issue is in dealing with it before it becomes almost a norm in our communities. And I think you were saying there's like a 4-year window for a lot of drugs to become commonplace. Is that a problem with ICE? Is it still a 4-year window? I mean, how far along are we? Is it that urgent? How urgent is it, I guess?
That research came from Alan Clough's research in the Northern Territory around the introduction of marijuana and some other drugs out there. And one of the things that I think helps us a little bit is that our communities have never really been into injecting stuff in a big way. I mean, the remote ones, we haven't picked it up. Like, we can't even get our mob to take their insulin injection. Like, we don't like needles generally, you know. So that's kind of kept us safe for a bit, for a while. But now, because this is really easy, ingest it, you know, you can smoke it and get ingested in a lot of different ways, that's a real problem for us, that, you know, it can come in different forms and stuff like that. Hey, what was your question? Oh, yeah, the four-year window.
Yeah, the four-year window, yeah.
So that was from Northern Territory data, and that's about how long it took to become endemic out there, so, like, really widespread. And so we just kind of applied that as well and said, well, potentially we have that kind of a window. But this drug is a lot more addictive than any of the other ones that we've had to deal with. So we wouldn't be sitting around waiting, you know, hoping that we've got a 4-year window in some of these communities where it isn't as rife as other places yet. No, we've got to get in now, and we've got to have these really strong responses both to the acute stuff and the specific substance, as well as that broader social emotional building up the communities and the rest of the things we need to deal with.
Gail?
One of the things I really want to say is housing is an issue with our mob. You know, right across, we used to have community-controlled housing organisations, and we used to have departments who focused on Aboriginal housing and other housing. But now they've just put it all in one bucket. We don't get housing funded anymore, and there's not just a set housing component for Indigenous housing. So that's gone by the wayside, and we really need to fix that problem, because that is one of the causes, and we need to do something about employment, you know, that no matter what. The education, housing, employment are really three key factors if we're trying to get on top of this. Families disarray because we don't have their own housing structure. They're not able to control their own families. By throwing two or three families into one home is causing angst amongst our mob. That's where social dysfunction happens.
And I think also the issue is to deal with trauma, and I think not a lot of people actually define it in a proper way, and substance abuse is also a symptom and a cause of this trauma. It's going to perpetuate that. How do we start to deal with this horrific trauma upon trauma in a lot of our communities?
You know, trauma has been going on. We've had the programs through the Bringing Them Home program and social emotional programs. But what we're finding that is even being watered down because, the government is funding different services to do a multitude of things in one community. So in Mareeba, we know that there's three or four organisations funded for, say, family intervention, but that is broken down because there are other people now funded to come into our community from outside the community to try and deal with it. So we're trying to work out who's doing what in our space so we can maximise services. But if we don't know all the people that are funded in our space, well, we can't work together.
Proper coordination is a key.
And look, the other thing, I mean, the trauma stuff is really current and really hard to deal with. In the communities we work up in the Cape, there's almost no chance to get over the last, and I'm talking about the current stuff here, you know, so this is the amount of deaths that happen in these communities. When people are still responding, you know, I was in communities where they didn't want to have You know, some families didn't want to have their kids' birthday party because they didn't want to be happy when there'd been so many other deaths in that community, you know. So it just compounds. So with that kind of a background, that makes it easy for these kind of things to come in. So, but we do have to address that. And honestly, we have nowhere near enough resources to address both social and emotional well-being and those kind of healing issues in these communities. And we're still trying to get ahead of the acute death kind of rates.
Yeah. And well, the rate of suicide and stuff is just extremely high. And we're not seeing that dealt with appropriately, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. We've just had a look at the Queensland suicide register and the death data around that, and looked at the Aboriginal specific stuff around that, and it's quite a different kind of a context for Aboriginal Islander people. Suicide, so different from mainstream, so different stresses and stuff like that, including things like having problems with the police, you know, which was one of the major ones for our mob, but didn't rate on the kind of mainstream thing. So there's things that we can intervene with here, but we're not putting much into it at the moment. Our kind of services are trying to, like, we're funded for chronic disease and maternal and child health, but we did a full ICE strategy, including designing our own posters and that kind of stuff, doing our own social media, getting other corporations on board like the Cowboys and stuff like that. But we're not ATODs, so we can't do all those responses, and we're not mental health. We put in for the IAS funding like every other Aboriginal organisation, and didn't come to us.
Didn't come to a lot of people.
It's probably time to wind up. Thank you both. Dr. Mark Wenatong and Gail Wason from over at Mareeba. Thank you both.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. We're broadcasting live today. Our Let's Talk program is coming live out of the annex of Parliament House. And
our next guest is Senator Jackie Lambie, who's had a lot to say about ICE on a national stage, and also Stephanie King from Mount Isa, Yarning Circles in Mount Isa. So we don't have a lot of time, but it's good to have you on the program. Senator, can we first ask you, what's your mob in your country?
Sorry.
Who's your mob? Who's your country? Where's your country? Aboriginal way. You identify as Aboriginal?
Yeah.
Is that all right? Tell us your mob, your country. It's one of the first questions we ask most people, black fella and white fella. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's the... I've just got the biggest blank this morning. It's the...
Well, let's move into something that is on the top of your brain, and that is this sort of... It'll come to you. Don't get putting pressure on yourself. It'll come to you.
We can ask Stephanie, eh? You're from Mount Isa. Who's your mob?
Hey, how you going? I'm Stephanie. My mob's a Wangi Gawa mob. And I'm from... I run some community yarning circles in Mount Isa. We started in December last year, mainly talking around the issue of drugs. There's a lot of people coming to us in concern, and also we'd had personal experiences within our families, you know. So, yeah, we wanted to raise the issue and do something proactive in the community around drugs.
In Mount Isa?
Yeah.
I'm good now. It's Manager Len.
Sorry to put it
it's
on.
It's too early in the morning.
Yeah.
Okay. All over me. Sorry about that. I'm very proud of that. Proud of that fact. So that is my mob from down there.
Who is it?
Manager Lena.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you made a lot of headlines, I think, a couple of months ago or earlier this month about your own personal sort of family history with ICE. Why did you think it was important to raise that issue?
I've really struggled out there the last couple of years. Even when I was running before I was elected as a senator, I was out there saying that we have an ICE problem, especially I could see it in my own backyard in Tasmania. So for me, I was out there, I was standing in front of premiers, I've been standing in front of politicians, and they sit there with a blank look on their face and they're saying we don't have a problem. Well, apparently now, since I've spoken 2.5, 3 weeks ago, we now have a problem. So... You know, as much as, and there's some journalists out there that say you threw your son under a bus. Well, I say this to those journalists under there. Right now, I have tried everything with my son, okay? I'm losing the battle to keep my son, to keep him human, okay? I'm dealing with a drug. So I'm getting to the point where I'm getting desperate. So for those journalists out there that say that I put my son under a bus, I say, you know what, when your son's got an ICE problem and when he's going through the same situation, when one of your sons is going through the same situation as what my son is, then come back and see me. But please, you know, I don't... throwing things under the carpet, putting things under the carpet is never going to solve the issue. We have a problem. We have a problem. We have a mental health problem out there. We have drug and alcohol problems, and we have a massive ICE problem out there. So let's be honest so we can tackle it. You can't tackle something until you admit you have a problem.
And it's all about being proactive. I imagine if the media had found out about your son, they would have run with it anyway. It would have been a reactive way you would have had to deal with it. So it's good to be proactive, which is what we were talking to Dr. Mark Wenatong about communities up in Cape York actually dealing with this problem first before it becomes a normalised behaviour.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you know, the more people out there talking about it, the more awareness. That's the best way to get awareness throughout the community. You can throw all the ads you like, but if people are out there actually talking about it, they're also coming up with solutions, and I think that's the best way forward.
What about solutions from the government? What do you want to see? What are you presenting? What are you demanding?
Okay, so what I'm presenting, I'll be presenting a private members' bill. Myself and Senator Xenophon will be to, so we can involuntary detox youth from 17 years and under. And the reason we're going to do that is because it's going to get quite difficult for people that are 18 years and over, because they're saying it's a constitutional problem, and they're making that into the debate. That's not the debate I want. What I want to be able to do is help those kids. So the first step will be to be able to get that private members bill through so we can voluntary detox our children. So those people out there that have got kids out there that are 11 and 12 on ice pipes and cannot get them help, you know, because they don't have the authority to do that as a parent, or the power, will now, you know, hopefully through Parliament, will now be able to have the power to do that.
So that bill gets up. Are the resources there? Are the facilities there for this detox? Because to my knowledge, the answer is simply no. Not even in the white side of town, let alone the black side of town.
Oh, absolutely not. No, no, no. So this will just be the first move. This will put the pressure on the government, and like the states can say, well, you know, because there's supposed to be state laws as well. So this will be the overall overriding policy, the national policy, to be able to do this. And what we do is we encourage the states and we say, well, you know what, we'll pick up the bill for your rehab sentence. So you'll have no excuse not to follow through with this bill. So where there's a will, there's a way, and that's what I'll be using. And like they were saying in here this morning, it also comes down to jobs. I've got 600,000 youth unemployed out there on the streets. You know, that's a problem. They're starting to lose their self-esteem. They're starting to see there's no hope for them in the world. Then they're going into drugs. This is why the suicide rate's coming up. You know, it's pretty much common sense what's going on out there.
Stephanie, I'm glad to have you here because I think it was last week, the Courier-Mail had Mounizer on the front page. They had these kids actually taking photos of these kids talking about it's a shame, like these Aboriginal parents have got their kids on the street on ice-fueled binges. How does your community react to media coverage like that that's again demonising and shaming our whole community?
Yeah, so the media can sometimes portray things in a different light, you know, like without actually knowing the real story behind that, and might be just, you know, that perception of what is going on and stuff like that. So, like, you know, that tends to happen. And
do you think it's more political as opposed to wanting to be a part of the solution and work with people? Do you think it's more political to sort of bring shame and more problems to the community? Because I don't see that being very positive, that sort of press.
No, seeing poor kids
stuff, you know?
On the front page of the Courier Mail.
Yeah, it's got to be shone in a different light. That's, you know, a negative light. But you know, like you've got to be honest too. There is issues that are happening. And it's just the way that... that's framed, you know, like, so, yeah, there is things that are happening, but once you get out into communities and you talk with people and you, you know, you have a good understanding and an idea of what actually is happening, you know, you're better able to advocate on those kind of things. So.
You're a young woman in Mount Isa. Are you in touch? Do you hear? Do you know? Do you see sort of what's going on in regards to whether ICE is an issue in Mount Isa, or is it more an issue over in Cairns or somewhere like that? I mean, as a young person in your own community, how do you see things?
I've been living in Mount Isa for 30 years now. Have grown up there, so it's my hometown. You know, like, and I'm in, it just depends on what environment that you're in to what exposure that you get. So, like, you know, like, in our family, it's affected us, and, you know, when you're living in that situation and you're seeing it happening all the time, you're seeing people getting injured, you're seeing people who are on it injuring others, people who are going to jail because of it, people who are dying from it. So once you see that constantly happening all the time, of course, you know, it's shouldn't be happening, you know. So it causes you to go, well, look, you know, we've got a major issue. You lose one person in the community, that's a major issue to me. That is a big... That's, you know, what stage do you say that it's an epidemic? Like, you know, it's becoming a problem once you, you know, you lose people from it. So, you know, this thing, we can't keep putting it under the, you know, in the shadows. It's really, it's about people coming out talking about it and raising awareness like Jackie has done, and, you know, sharing those stories and saying, you know, this is the impact that it has on people, you know. What can we all do proactively, and not be reactive about it? It's about working together, and it's about getting people, you know, healthy and well, and putting, making sure that communities have the services that they need or the support structures that they need, so that people can access health services, or they, you know, they have a choice to get healthy and well. You know, you've got these rural remote communities. We don't have the luxury of being able to go to, you know, like, you know, an easily accessible rehab or some sort of service there, you know. We're dealing with, you know, not many job opportunities. There's, you know, little communities, not many business opportunities. So it's a lot of stresses for people too that live in these communities too as well. So, yeah, it's a lot of pressure. So I think...
Senator Lambie, we don't often hear a lot of Aboriginal voices in Parliament. It's yourself, Senator Nova Peris, and another Senator, Joe Lingan, is it? Is that... She's... Yeah. When you hear a voice like Stephanie's voice, how can we ensure that Aboriginal... Because I think there are differences in the way Aboriginal people are approaching ICE. How can we ensure that that's sort of reflected in the national debate, so that it doesn't... Because it's obviously a white problem as well, but it doesn't get covered over, and that we ensure we keep our voices out there on the national political stage?
First of all, in just what you said, you know, fixing this problem, you will not be able to use the same treatment for everybody.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that... That's certainly out there. There's no easy way to this, so we're all going to have to join forces, and we're all going to have to come together as one to be able to fight. There's going to have to fight fire with fire. So, you know, we're going to have the courage to come together and fight it as one. There's no doubt about that. So it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all. Secondly, and I keep calling for this, I would love to see dedicated Indigenous seats in Parliament. You know, it's been... New Zealand has shown that they've been able to do it and do it very, very well, and they've been able to close the gap, whereas ours is widening. So, and, you know, it doesn't matter what colour skin that you have, it doesn't matter what religion you are, because I can tell you what's going on in my backyard, in Burnie itself, in Tasmania, with, you know, people down there, they're on welfare, there's no jobs, and this is really disheartening to youth. You know, they've been at school, they've done year 11, 12, they're moving on with uni, and they still can't get out with a job. So it's really knocking their self-esteem. And this is turning them into... This is making... Turning it into a vicious cycle for them, and therefore they're weakening. And those people that are peddling drugs, it makes it easier for those bloody drug pushers out there to peddle drugs onto our youth. And this is what... They're easy targets. And it's really, really sickening that a lot of these people are doing that, are adults doing this to our kids. I find it disgusting. So, you know, it's the problem itself is not just about the rehabilitation, it's also about the policing, it's also about these big drug dealers up here when they're caught, that their assets are seized, and those assets, that money is then turned over and put back into the rehabilitation. It's a problem that's going to take a lot of areas to fix it. And this is what I mean, coming together as one.
Most certainly. It's almost time for news. Jackie Lambie, thanks for joining us. Good to have sitting in on the program. And Stephanie, young Stephanie King from Mount Isa. Thank you for joining us, eh?
Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
Yep. That about winds it up for us here, Amy.
Yeah, but I'll be sticking around all day to listen in, and we'll have some more interviews maybe next week.
Very good. And, well, you all have a great weekend. We're, as you've heard, we're broadcasting live from the Annex of Parliament House with our Let's Talk today. And we hope you'll join us again on Monday morning for your local, Let's Talk on your local First Nation station. So you'll have a great day.
And a great weekend.
And a great weekend. Back Monday.